Celebrating the new works of the last 12 months, this year with a particular focus on vocal music. Performance on 3, Wednesday night from 7 on BBC Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news now read by John Shea.
Tens of thousands of people are taking part in a march in Dublin's city centre this lunchtime to protest against the Irish government's austerity measures. International talks are continuing to finalise a bailout plan worth €85 billion, about £72 billion, before markets reopen on Monday. But there's anger over the interest rate that the Irish Republic could be charged. Ed Miliband has promised to make Labour the People's Party as he launched a comprehensive review of its policies. He told the party's National Policy Forum that it had to move beyond New Labour and change the way it thought about such issues as the economy and the community if it was to win back power. The Royal Navy officer in charge of a nuclear-powered submarine which ran aground on a shingle bank off the Isle of Skye has been relieved of his command. HMS Astute was on sea trials last month when it became stuck for about 10 hours. A spokesman said Commander Andy Coles had been moved to other duties. A Somali-born American citizen has been charged in the United States with attempting to use a weapon of mass destruction following a sting operation by police. Mohammed Osman Mohammed, who's 19, was arrested in the city of Portland after trying to detonate what he thought was a car bomb at a Christmas tree lighting ceremony. The device was actually a fake supplied by undercover agents. A lawyer for the WikiLeaks website has dismissed comments by officials in the United States suggesting that lives will be put at risk if it publishes tens of thousands of American diplomatic files. Mark Stevens said Washington was trying to reduce media coverage of the leaks. North Korea has accused South Korea of using civilians as human shields on an island that it attacked earlier this week. Two civilians and two South Korean Marines were killed during the North's artillery bombardment on Tuesday. The weather and a number of severe weather warnings remain in place, with Scotland and Northern Ireland, as well as northeast and southeast England, expected to be worst affected by snow and freezing temperatures. A severe overnight frost is expected, with snow especially in the north and east. Forecasters say the cold snap could last for up to 2 weeks. The news and weather on BBC Radio 3 at almost 3 minutes past one.
And it was read by John Shea. Well, time now on Radio 3 for Lucy Skeeping to continue the early music show's contributions to the Radio 3 opera season. Today it's the turn of Handel's Alcina.
Thank you. The overture to Handel's opera Alcina, performed there by Il Compresso Barocco, directed by Alan Curtis. Alcina is the focus of today's Early Music Show, and I spoke to Alan a few weeks ago from a radio studio in Florence, where he now lives. Some people have all the luck. He and his ensemble have recorded 14 of Handel's 40-odd operas. So one of the first questions I asked him was how he first encountered Handel's stage works and what sort of impression they had on him.
Well, my first Handel opera staged was Giulio Cesare in Munich many years ago, 55, my first trip to Europe. And I was very impressed, and I can still visualize the Vatacito aria. And I also was very impressed with how enthusiastic the public was for something that I didn't know about, Handel opera. The next important encounter was in 60 when Joan Sutherland sang Alcina. And I wish I could have gone to that. It was a Zeffirelli lavish production, which I probably wouldn't like now, but I certainly would have adored in 1960.
Absolutely and, wonderful.
I adored Sutherland. It was the first time, not only for a Handel opera that was so so impressive, but it was also the first time I'd ever heard any singer who had a voice you could instantly recognize. Once you heard Joan Sutherland, you could hear her on a radio in the next room and say, ah, that's Joan Sutherland. And I was also, of course, very taken with the opera and immediately bought the recording and listened to it many times.
Joyce DiDonato singing that aria from Handel's opera Alcina, with Alan Curtis conducting Il Complesso Barocco. And as you heard a few moments ago, it was the legendary Joan Sutherland's 1959 recording of that very aria that was a particular inspiration to Alan, who's my guest today. The opera itself was Handel's first commission from the brand new opera house in Covent Garden, and it premiered in the spring of 1735 with a star-studded cast, which we know included not only Cecilia Young, the wife of the composer Thomas Arne, but also the controversial French dancer and choreographer Marie Salé. So what's the story of Alcina? Well, it's a typically convoluted plot taken from Ariosto's epic poem Orlando Furioso. It's full of magic, mystery, mayhem and murder, and it's quite hard to follow, to be honest, but here goes. It all concerns a heroic knight called Ruggiero and his long-suffering fiancée Bradamante. No doubt due to his hunky good looks, he's constantly being kidnapped by sorcerers, and this time by two particularly lusty ones, Alcina and her sister Morgana, who reside on an island in the middle of the ocean. They seduce every male that sets foot there, and when they get bored of them, they transform them into stones, animals, plants, or just about anything else that takes their fancy. Nice. We come in as Bradamante, disguised as her own brother Ricciardo, arrives on the island with her friend Melisso to search for her lover. They manage to get into Alcina's court, where, incidentally, Morgana falls for Bradamante in her masculine disguise, and they find Ruggiero in a state of amnesia, looking adoringly at Alcina. We then get a lot of duelling between the various captives who are jealous of this handsome newcomer, but to cut a long story just a little bit shorter, Ruggiero puts on the magic ring which Bradamante has brought with her, did I mention that before, which enables the wearer to see through illusions. It does the trick, and Ruggiero finally comes to his senses and sees that, far from being a sensual paradise, Alcina's island is actually a desert peopled with monsters. Of course, actually escaping is another matter, especially as Alcina now reveals a true human-style love for Ruggiero and lays on the magic even thicker to keep him captive. Morgana, meanwhile, having fallen for Ricciardo, who's really Bradamante in disguise, keep up, is having relationship issues with her lover Oronte, while another captive, the young Oberto, gets strangely attached to a lion who turns out to be his long-lost father. Are you still with me? And Alcina becomes suicidal as she realises she's losing Ruggiero. In the climax of the work, Ruggiero smashes the urn which contains all Alcina's magic powers. Well, you would, wouldn't you? And the palace and sorceresses crumble into dust. So that's it. Pretty much a typical Baroque opera plot, you might say, and I don't suppose Handel's audiences followed it any better than we might, since they tended to pop in and out of their theatre boxes quite a lot during the show for, say, a supper break or a chat with friends in between appearances by their favourite Italian opera stars. But for those that did get stuck into the intricacies of the plot, there are deeper meanings to be found beneath the surface, as Alan Curtis explains.
Superficially, one could say that it's a typical Baroque opera, but there are two things that are atypical, and one is, as you say, the popular element. It has so much variety. There's a, in a sense, something for everyone. But in the other sense, it has then what I would call Handel's subplot, which is that he actually goes against the grain of the original intent of the libretto, which was an allegory to show the evil of dangerous women, let's put it that way. And Alcina is certainly a dangerous woman. But Handel makes her, without taking away any of the evil parts, in fact, making at the end when she tries to get Oberto to kill his own father in the form of a lion, she's seen as a very cruel person. But Handel takes that cruelty and makes it into something that is really just an expression of Alcina's despair. And she's desperate because she's in love. It's as if that's her entire life, is all-consuming love. And as someone put it, if anyone has ever felt their powers waning when they were afraid that the power of their attraction was falling away, then they will have an identification with Alcina. ¶¶
A woman scorned. When you return with your feet in fetters, look only for harshness and cruelty from me. Joyce DiDonato singing that angry aria from the third act of Handel's opera Alcina. Handel, of course, always had a librettist of the highest quality that he could rely on for a new production. So who was responsible for converting Ariosto's epic poem into words that Handel could set to music? Here's Alan Curtis.
It's best to simply consider it anonymous. I wrote down anonymous when I did the recording, and I got back the program notes for the recording with the name Antonio Fonsalia. And I thought, who is that? I've never heard of him. So I looked him up, couldn't find out anything about him in my dictionaries. And then I thought, well, let's try internet. There are 14,000 entries for Antonio Fonsalia if you Google him. But they're all, it turns out, I didn't check them all, but it's clear that they're all based on the mistaken notion that he wrote the libretto. He actually had nothing to do with it. He was an impresario who sponsored one of the versions of the story. But the libretto that we know is a very clever rewrite by an anonymous Italian living in London of an equally anonymous libretto that was set by Farinelli's, the great castrato's brother, Riccardo Boschi. And that was published in Florence in 1728, 7 years before Handel.
And would Handel have been aware of all that?
Oh, yes, I'm sure he had a copy of it, or at least his librettist did.
There's a bit of a story behind one of the arias connected with the singer who was supposed to be singing it, isn't there? Tell us about that.
Well, Giovanni Carestini, who was a wonderful mezzo-soprano castrato, who had started his career with Alessandro Scarlatti and Vivaldi, he was brought to London and had an enormous success. Handel wrote Ariodante and Ruggiero in Alcina for him. And he was famous for virtuoso arias, but Handel knew that he could also do beautifully simple, touching aria. So he wrote one, Verdi Prati, using a text that was actually intended for Bradamante, Ruggiero's sposa. But Handel brilliantly gave it instead to Ruggiero, and it has a wonderful effect at the end of the second act of nostalgia as he leaves Alcina's magic isle. Carestini said, no, no, this is not suitable for my voice. And Handel heard that he had said this to somebody, and he went to his house, they say, and said, you talk, you sing what I tell you to sing, or I don't pay you a stiver.
And, so what happened?
Well, he sang it.
As you would.
Presumably beautifully. In fact, Bernie tells us that it was encored every night. And so it must have been a big hit, and Carestini must have realized Handel did know what he was talking about.
Mitre Beaumont in the role of Ruggiero with that touching aria from Handel's opera Alcina, from the 2007 recording directed by Alan Curtis. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Lucy Skeeping. So, Alcina was first heard in the first season at the new Covent Garden Theatre, built by John Rich in the 1730s. The facilities there were state-of-the-art, which meant that designers could really indulge in all the latest special effects and magical stagecraft. Alan Curtis again.
It must have been quite spectacular. If you think of the quality of the visual arts in those days and the quality of theatre, some of the major artists of the day did theatre design. It wasn't so specialised as now. Of course, we still have someone like David Hockney working in the theatre, but in those days it was even more common for major artists to work in the theatre. And it must have been a very splendid level of visual aspect on the same high level as the musical.
I mean, they didn't seem to have the thing that we often have in the modern theatre today, which is kind of less is more. You know, there's a certain sort of snobbery and minimalism. Back there, you know, pile it on, that was fine.
Yes, but I think what they piled on must have been of very high quality. It wasn't just Baroque, as we say. One of the great things was the contrast, and you can see that in the dramaturgy, that there are scenes that are very rich and very necessarily complicated, but they're usually succeeded by very simple and very direct scenes. And some of them probably played with minimalism, but very briefly. And the thing that I think would totally bore a member of Handel's audience would be if they went to a modern production in which there was no set change whatsoever. It would be considered unbelievably poor.
But of course, in Handel's time, all this was achieved with an absolute army of people under the stage, at the side of the stage, pulling things, lighting candles, blowing them out.
Yes, and hell scenes, of course, one of the reasons theatres caught fire so often was that hell scenes did have real fire. And there are directions about how to take explosive powder and bring it up to the candle and make it explode in the stage. And then it flops down and they load it again, and so the explosions would have been constant. It was a very dangerous business.
And of course, very much part of the visual spectacle was dancing, which was a major part of opera. Sometimes we think of the these days, again, you know, there may be a dance interlude or a kind of movement interlude, but here this is a big thing, wasn't it?
Yes, and the ending of Act Two of Ariodante, which actually got moved into Alcina, though it doesn't belong there. It was published there in the 19th century, and some people still do it. I think it's all wrong to put that music into Alcina. But that is an example of a dance that is completely connected to the plot. In fact, absolutely necessary. It's the nightmare of Ginevra at the end of Act Two. The corresponding place at the end of Act Two in Alcina is equally complicated, and again, accompanied recitative plays a very important part. And this is one of the scenes that Mrs. Pendarvis, one of Handel's great fans, raved about when she first heard it at a rehearsal. And she was right, it is one of the glories of the opera. The scene in which Alcina hears the spirits and tries to get them to work for her. It's the lead-up to the great aria, Ombre Pallide.
Thank you. Oh!
The sorceress Alcina leaves the stage at the end of Act Two and hurls aside her magic wand as her beloved Ruggiero flees into the distance. Joyce DiDonato as Alcina with Il Complesso Barocco, conducted by Alan Curtis. When I spoke to Alan from the Rai studio in Florence a few weeks ago, I asked him to explain the role of the chorus in Alcina, which was quite a new tactic for Handel.
The pair, Alcina Ariodante, both have more use of chorus than was usual previously. That's part of the lavishness of the new Covent Garden. But it also is part of Handel's concept of the opera, and it doesn't need to be a wild expense, in that we know from Handel's autograph that he used the soloists. And I've had to show my soloists Handel's autograph and have them see Faustina, Cuzzone and Senesino listed as singing the choral parts before they will accept the idea of singing the choruses themselves. Nowadays, of course, a soloist considers it insulting to sing a chorus, but in Handel's day, the word coro just meant ensemble, and often the chorus was sung only by the soloists. In the case of Alcina and Ariodante, we have documentation that the soloists were augmented with some singers. Some of them, in fact, like Stoppelaar, a Dutchman, had other roles. In fact, he sang Odoardo, the solo role in Ariodante. But they were not major singers, and they doubled up on the choruses. So the choruses were either two or three on a part, probably.
The chorus from the first act of Handel's opera Alcina. The sorceress's palace is revealed for the first time. This is the pinnacle of delight, the heart of enjoyment. Here is Elysium for the living, where pleasure fashions heroes. The excerpts we've been hearing all come from a recording Alan Curtis and his group Il Complesso Barocco made in 2007, which brought together a fantastic lineup of singers. I know from experience how intense it can be in the recording studio, especially getting together a major work like this in a limited time. So how did he enjoy the experience?
It was a wonderful experience. We were in a little village north of Rome, a beautiful town, nothing to do except concentrate on the music and take walks in this beautiful setting. And it was a wonderful atmosphere. Everybody got along with everybody else. Nobody got sick. It was magic. Alcina's magic.
How long does it take to record something like that?
We usually do a 3.5 hour recording in a week of recording sessions, I mean.
What made you decide to use women's voices instead of countertenors for the castrati roles?
Well, I have nothing against countertenors, and the good ones are very, very good indeed. And I have recently done some recordings. In fact, our very latest has Demetrio sung by Franco Fagioli. But let's start with Handel. When Handel couldn't get an alto castrato, he took a female contralto, even though there were good countertenors, probably wonderful countertenors, available in London at the time. It's not that Handel never used a countertenor, especially for Italian opera. He most often would take an Italian woman, not just because of the language, I think, but also because they had a kind of a power in the lower register that countertenors just don't have. If he had written a piece for someone like Senesino, and Senesino was not available, I think Handel simply would not have given it, and the evidence is that he didn't give it to a countertenor, but he gave it to a female contralto. And there were plenty of them around who specialized in male roles, so that was not a problem. If they were a good actress, they could do the role convincingly.
Laura Cherici is the young boy Oberto who's searching for his lost father. a role which, at the premiere of Alcina back in 1735, Handel had sung by a boy treble. That first run of the opera was extremely lavish, just the thing to attract audiences to John Rich's impressive new Covent Garden Theatre. But just how was it received at the time?
It was a very important enterprise for Handel. I think he felt, rightly probably, that it was either succeed at this or give up altogether. He did succeed, but at a great cost, I think both to his health and to his finances. It was a very lavish and expensive production, clearly, and it was a success, but he then declared that he was leaving England and going to rest and would only do concerts the next year. So he must have been rather discouraged by the cost of this success, let's say.
And another opera company in London as well, sort of splitting the audiences, Alan.
Yes, well, of course, London could barely support one opera company, and having two rivals meant that, of course, they both floundered. The rival company had Farinelli, who was the most famous singer in Europe. They seemed to have an assured success, but Handel, even though he lost all his great singers, Faustina, Cuzzoni, Senesino, they all went over to the competition, except for one loyal woman who was said to be no beauty. In fact, she was called the pig. But Anna Strada del Po remained faithful to Handel. She refused to sing for Bononcini, Handel's rival. And I think of Alcina as her just reward. Handel simply wrote such glorious music for her, and with such a variety, and I would say also with such a progression from the first very sexy aria to the last tragic, tearful one. It's a gradual disintegration of a beautiful and powerful woman.
Thank you.
Alcina's last aria of desolate resignation. Only tears remain to me, tears that would call my heart's desires. Heaven itself is deaf to me. Joyce DiDonato in the role of Alcina with Il Complesso Barocco, directed by Alan Curtis. And I'm afraid that brings to an end today's Early Music Show. My thanks to Alan Curtis for his insights into the opera and, of course, for his excellent recording, which we've been hearing throughout the programme.
Today's Early Music Show was presented by Lucy Skeeping and produced in Manchester by Les Pratt. And Lucy will be back tomorrow afternoon with a programme dedicated to the life and music of the Venetian composer Giovanni Legrenzi. Do tune in for that if you can, just after the 1 o'clock news tomorrow afternoon. And keeping opera very much in the frame, one of Mozart's greatest later on today. Young, arrogant, contemptuous and sexually voracious, Don Giovanni is the dissolute aristocrat who doesn't take no for an answer. But in the end, even he comes up against something he can't dupe, evade or kill. Mozart's Don Giovanni is our opera on three tonight. It comes live from English National Opera and stars one of the UK's most exciting singers, Ian Paterson, in the title role, leading an outstanding cast conducted by Kirill Karabits. Presenter Susie Klein's joined by novelist Jeanette Winterson to discuss the multi-layered music and the production theatre. I beg your pardon, the production by theatre director Rufus Norris. So that's our opera on three this evening, Mozart's Don Giovanni, live from the London Coliseum, starting at 6:15. And looking ahead briefly to BBC television offerings this week.
In a new series for BBC Two, the historian Amanda Vickery opens the door on the private lives of the Georgians.
I'll take you into the palaces of the wealthy, the parlours of the middle classes, and the attics of the servants and the poor.
Unlocking the secrets and the scandals hidden amongst the soft furnishings.
These houses reflected your taste, your character, your moral values, and even the state of your marriage.
At Home with the Georgians starts this Thursday night at 9 o'clock on BBC Two.
You're listening to BBC Radio 3, just gone 2 minutes past two, and now a second chance to hear last Monday's lunchtime concert from London's Wigmore Hall. It was introduced by Fiona Torkington.
Schubert's Death and the Maiden string quartet is a piece of great contrasts, pain and solace, light and shade. It's music which is both chilling and compelling. The world-renowned Tokarczuk Quartet is here at Wigmore Hall this lunchtime to play not just this quartet, but also another, inspired by Death and the Maiden, which was written for them by the American composer Daniel Kellogg. And it's this piece, Soft Sleep Shall Contain You, which begins today's concert, receiving its UK premiere. Kellogg says he was intrigued by the poem by Matthias Claudius, which Schubert said first as a song and then went on to use as a quotation in the song in his string quartet. Death has come for a young maiden. She pleads with him to pass by, but soothingly he says, "Give me your hand. I am a friend and come not to punish." Daniel Kellogg says that his music meditates on the drama of this conversation, using the contrasts of major and minor, the struggle and the tensions, the stillness and the chaos played out in his music. And now here are the members of the Tokarczuk Quartet, the violinists Edward Dusenberry and Karoly Schranz, the viola player Geraldine Walther and cellist Andras Fire to play Daniel Kellogg's Soft Sleep Shall Contain You.